This is an interview with Bill Jenneke for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is July 13th, 2011. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, James. Glad to be with you.
All right, to start off, I wanted to ask you, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Washington Heights, in the northern part of Manhattan Island, in 1937, in a neighborhood that was fascinating because it was a very cosmopolitan neighborhood of about 40% Irish, 40% German Jews who had fled Hitler, and the rest was a mixture of Italians and Hispanics and some African Americans. And because of that mixture, you got to know a lot about different cultures and different people and different religions. And as a kid, before I went to school, I thought everybody in the world was Jewish. So I learned to speak Yiddish. And they'd see this little red-headed kid speaking Yiddish, and they think it was hysterical. But I've forgotten it all, so don't give me any test on my Yiddish. So I went to local schools and then went to Manhattan College, 1956.
Just to interrupt you, were either of your parents involved in securities at all?
No. My father took business at NYU, was an accountant for the Maritime Commission, and my mother was a stay-at-home, lived in a rent-controlled apartment, six-story apartment, and we were considered wealthy because we had an elevator in our building, so that sort of was a dividing line.
Oh, that's something.
About elevators were.
Yeah. So you said you ended up going to Manhattan College. What did you study there?
I studied electrical engineering. That was the peak of the space race. Khrushchev had become Secretary General, and he, of course, had gotten Yuri Gagarin as the first man in space, and stuck his thumb in our eye, and Eisenhower's eye, and then Kennedy's. And it became a holy grail mission for the United States to catch up. And we were frightened at the Russian military capabilities. And the place to get involved was electrical engineering. That's where the future was. So I decided to major in that. Transistors were just coming online. We used to, when I first went to Manhattan, everything was vacuum tubes. Mm-hmm. When I left, everything was transistors.
Did you hope to work for NASA or for the space program?
I wanted to work for any organization that would have high tech and could lead to a career, long-term career, that might be in the space program or whatever. And in junior year, I had a summer job. I needed the money. And I applied to Grumman out on Long Island. Grumman was the prime contractor for the lunar excursion module, if you remember what that was. And I sent my resume to them. They said, well, thinking about it, we'll get back to you. And they took too long to get back to me. And an offer came along, a very interesting offer, from the New York Central Railroad, of all things. You think of the railroad as sort of a stodgy old organization. But it was headed by Alfred E. Perlman, who was a dynamic mechanical engineer from MIT. And he had this thing for young engineering boys that would be his replacement and take over. So they made an offer I couldn't refuse for the summer internship. And then I got to know the place so well and the people so well, enjoyed the experience so well. I was always a train buff. I thought I had died and gone to heaven working for a railroad, being paid to do things that I would have done for nothing. And I worked for them for a number of years in the computer area. And that led to an opportunity to go to Xerox. Excuse me. Xerox.
So just to check, you graduated in 1960 and then you worked for the railroad for a while.
Right.
And then 64 you went to work for Xerox.
Correct.
Okay.
And oddly enough, going to work for Xerox got me closer to NASA because Xerox had some contracts for technology products that it sold to NASA, and I was a support engineer on that.
What sort of products were they?
The central product was an extremely high-speed facsimile system that would transmit a page in 5 seconds. And at that time, that was really hot stuff. It was a terrible bandwidth hog. It took 60 voice channels for a single transmission of sender to receiver. But it was so important to high-speed, especially graphic communications for NASA and in Air Force One, that we sold a boatload of them to NASA and then to another of other high-tech companies. And then we found out in 1966 that we plateaued. We had penetrated the market to the point that all of the low-hanging fruit had been gathered, and we decided to start to cut back the program. And I decided I wanted to go back to the railroad because they made me an offer again that I couldn't refuse. In the cybernetics department, that was Alfred Perlman's name for advanced systems development. Cybernetics being the application of technology to mimic the human actions in controlling processes and so forth. And I became a project manager on a number of projects there. Mm-hmm. And then...
Still with the railroad.
And then in 1968, the New York Central and the Pensy merged. And I had a worm's eye view of that merger, and I could see it wasn't going to work. Terrible human interactions on the part of management. And I decided I was going to leave. Prescient, because 2 years later went bust. And then I answered an ad in 1968, ad in the New York Times, for the American Stock Exchange. They wanted a communications coordinator, somebody who would be able to have the member firms of the American Stock Exchange and the floor communicate electronically. And I had a lot of expertise from my time on the railroad in that area.
Did they have any system in place to do that?
They had no time? The system in place was pneumatic tubes. And the word had come down from the SEC that what was happening in the brokerage industry could not continue, because the industry was literally coming to its knees.
This is what was called the back office crisis.
Right, right.
Tell me what that was.
A paperwork crisis. Basically what happened in the mid-1960s, it was a bull market, and the institutions, mainly the mutual funds and the pension funds, moved into the market in a big way. And the trading volume was such that the back offices of the brokers couldn't keep up with it. The brokers wound up unable to deliver securities because they couldn't get the physical certificates back from the transfer agents. And they wound up with a fail. And then when you have a fail, keeping track of where the dividends belong and all that sort of thing becomes a monumental accounting problem, and tremendous write-offs took place, and a lot of big brokers went out of business, like Goodbody and FI DuPont and others.
They even started closing down for one day a week.
That's right. Now, they closed down on Wednesday, all day Wednesday. The other days were 10 to 2. And that didn't do it, because all they did was push that much more volume into the remaining trading days. And the crisis had to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. And the federal government, the SEC, but mainly Congress, both houses of Congress, thought the answer to this problem was to nationalize the clearance and settlement system, because Congress would know best how to run something. It would be a first and a last. So they actually drafted bills in both houses. And at that time, just now we're talking about 1969, 1970, paperwork crisis had tailed off a bit, but it was still something that everybody knew was going to come back.
Mm-hmm. Have they already tried to implement some technological solutions to that problem?
There was a lot of talk and nothing of any meaning, other than the New York Stock Exchange began this central certificate service. Which was a book entry system, which was the precursor to DTC.
That was created in 1966, right?
It was they took their first deposits in 1966, uh-huh. Their first book entry deliveries in 1968. But the key problem with that was that it was for brokers only. And the real problem in delivering securities was not as much between brokers as it was between a broker and the institutional customer. And the institutional customer had something called a COD privilege, meaning that unlike the retail customer who had to pay on settlement day, and then when he got his certificates, he got his certificates. The institutional customer wouldn't pay until the certificates were delivered. So now the broker has had to pay the other broker, the selling broker, and he's sitting there and he's waiting to deliver securities to the institution, or the institution's custodian bank, and there's no certificates. So the certificates are stuck in transfer.
Let me ask you, was the central certificate service only for New York Stock Exchange customers, or did the other?
It's only for New York Stock Exchange brokers and New York Stock Exchange issues. And it got off to an inglorious start. It crashed. For the first time they attempted to bring it up, and then they decided they'd bring it up more slowly and carefully. And the second pass worked all right, but it was lacking the key ingredient, and that was the institutional customer's custodian banks. So that led to one of the seminal events that I think was a humorous event. It's funny when top people work together, things that stick in their minds often involve some sort of a humorous incident. And in this case, it was Ralph Saul, who was president and CEO of the American Stock Exchange, former director of, I think it was at the time, it might have been called Trading and Markets at the SEC. And very highly regarded as Mr. Clean. The Amex had some scandals. He came in, cleaned it up, and then he's faced with all of these problems, paperwork problems. And he got to know Walter Wriston. Walter Wriston was the president, the chairman and CEO of First National Citibank, soon to become Citibank. And called up Wriston, and he says, "You've got a terrible problem, you know. You're supposed to turn around transfers within 2 days, and it's taking you 2 weeks." And Wriston said, "No, that's not possible. Come on over, I'll buy you lunch and I'll take you on a tour." Went over, got his lunch, took the tour, and then Wriston said, "You know, Saul was wrong. It wasn't taking 2 weeks. It was taking 3 weeks." And Wriston never got tired of telling that story. To the delight of people listening. And that led to an awareness on the part of the big banks and the big bank transfer agents that they had a problem. And they had to deal with the brokers to solve the problem. Otherwise, Washington was going to impose a solution to the problem. And they didn't want that to happen. "I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. Take no offense." And Nixon was in the White House at the time, so you had an administration that was sort of pro-business. So the idea was, let's get together at the very highest level of banking and brokerage, CEO level, form a committee, and we'll call it Banking and Securities Industry Committee.
Basic.
And they did that in the very beginning of 1970.
Now, did BASIC have its own staff, or was it just these heads of the organizations working part-time?
Yeah, let me explain that to you, because that's important. And that's why I'm here. BASIC was comprised of three big bank CEOs who it was agreed among the clearinghouse banks that they would speak for the clearinghouse. So Rist and John Meyer and Bill Moore became the representatives. John Meyer of Morgan, because he's, you know, Morgan still had that cachet, you know, he became the chairman. And David Rockefeller and the other high rollers said, yes, I'm giving you my proxy, you can speak for us. And then the brokerage side was the president of the New York Stock Exchange, president of the Amex, Saul, president of the NASD. And they decided that they needed somebody to do the real work. Committees, you know, can't do staff work. Herman Beavis had just retired as the CEO of Price Waterhouse. You probably know Price Waterhouse was, you know, the Cadillac of the Big Eight. It was the Big Eight in those days. And Herman had known John Meyer very well because he was on their account and they used to have martinis at lunch together. And became fast friends. So they hired Herman to be the executive director and the seventh voting member of BASIC. Herman said, I will take the job only if it's pro bono. And they said, well, we got to pay you something. He said, you can pay me in the form of a donation to the Greenwich Hospital, where he was, I think, on the board. And they paid him back then, the hospital they paid, mm-hmm. $50,000. And they expected it would last a year. Well, it didn't last a year. For him, it lasted 3.5-4 years. Right. But it was still the same $50,000. And Herman decided he needed some presumably bright young guys to help him get the facts and produce first drafts and that sort of thing. And I was finishing up my project at the Amex, and I got a call from Paul Colton, who was the COO at the Amex, executive vice president. And he said, come up and see me. And I said, what is this? God is, I'm going up to see God. And he said, we're very pleased with the work you've done, and we think you have a lot to offer this new BASIC thing. And you go to work, if you're willing, for Herman Beavis for 2 years, up to 2 years. And you'll stay on our payroll, but you'll report to him. And there'll be five others who will be like you, who have different types of expertise. There's one transfer agent person, one delivery person, you know, one general management person, and I was the technology person. And I went over to Herman Beavis. I can remember this as though it was yesterday. It's one of those events, like Robert Frost, you know, the fork in the road. Mm-hmm. And I went into 60 Broad Street, where Price Waterhouse had their offices, and Herman was there in a small room by himself, and nice, courtly Southern gentleman who grew up poor in Alabama, went to, I think, East Tennessee College, modest, you know, and but somehow or other, Price Waterhouse thought he was worthy to go to Harvard B, so they sent him there, and he, I think, took an instant liking to me, but he wasn't sure, he didn't want any surprises. This was going to be a very visible assignment. And so we chatted a little bit, and then he said that, Bill, this is going to be something that the media is going to follow, and there are going to be some people who will try to oppose us, and I want to make sure that there's no surprises and there's nothing in your background that would embarrass us. So I'm thinking, what does he think? I'm, a child molester or something. And he said, can you think of anything that might be a problem? And I said, I really can't, Mr. Beavis. It was Mr. Beavis at that point. I said, but you should know that my experience is in the front end of the business and taking orders in, getting those orders executed. And your effort is going to be about the stock certificate and streamlining the back end. And I said, Mr. Beavis, to tell you the truth, I don't know the difference between a stock and a bond. And he said, you're just the guy I want. And we were off to the races at that point. It was love at first sight. And I had the privilege of working for him for two solid years, two and a half solid years, and then on and off for another 18 months. And Paul Colton had told me that going to work for Herman Beavis would be like getting a master's in the securities business, as he was trying to encourage me to do this. And when Basic finally went out of business, it was driven by Herman. Herman said, there's no reason for a committee to stay in business once it has achieved its objective. It should go out of business. So we had a little get-together of the Basic members, and some of the task force people still left. I was the recording secretary, and I said, can I say something for the staff? And I said about how Paul Colton had said, I get my master's degree. I said, Paul left out that working for Herman Beavis was like getting your PhD in the securities industry, but also in how to live. Mm-hmm. He was such an extraordinary gentleman. He met with some of the most junior people, clerks in back offices, and you'd never know that he was anybody special. Or he could talk to Richard Nixon and with the same comfort. And so he taught me that. He taught me that it's a question of respect. Respect for your fellow human being. And I just can't say enough good things about that experience. But we have to move on.
Right. It sounds like a great learning opportunity.
Right.
So one of the first big issues that you all had to decide was what to do about the stock certificate.
Right.
What were your options, and how did you all make that decision?
The two major options that were being pushed by the industry were to take CCS, take it away from the stock exchange, buy out the stock exchange for their investment in it, and make it a cooperative, owned and controlled by the users, all the users, including the banks. The banks said, we're not going to put our securities into this thing unless we have a voice in the board of directors and in the management. So that was the main direction that Herman pushed for, testifying before Congress and giving Congress progress reports and so forth. And the stock exchange was sort of pushed into this thing somewhat reluctantly. I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago, but now it's ancient history. They didn't want to give up this crown jewel. They saw this thing as a potential huge profit maker. Mm-hmm. But the pressure was there, political pressure was there, so they, under Herman's guidance and direction, they finally agreed to the plan to spin it off, make it into the depository trust company, a cooperative, New York State a limited purpose trust company, and a member of the Federal Reserve. I think it was the first limited purpose trust company that the Fed took in.
Explain to me really quickly why they thought that it was such a big potential money maker. Was it because there was just so much volume?
That's right. And it was really the answer to paperwork problems and the costs associated with the physical certificate processing. During my time at DTC, and one of the first things I did in 1974, I worked with some brokers to find out what does it cost to process a receipt of physical certificates compared to what does it cost to take in a book entry delivery. And a physical receipt back then, in those dollars, 1974 dollars, was typically $10 to $15. When you take all the costs and the errors and rejects and, you know, the whole nine yards and distribute it over the number of units. Whereas a book entry delivery was less than a tenth of that. So, and the stock exchange didn't know those numbers, but they had a gut feel for the value added of this thing.
Right.
And that over the long term, 5-10 years, it would be a moneymaker for the stock exchange, and measured in the tens of millions of dollars a year, or maybe more.
Mm-hmm. Now, at a very early date, Basic recommended against eliminating the stock certificate altogether.
That's right.
They came upon this solution of immobilization.
Right.
But at the same time, there were a number of voices on the street and in the SEC and even at the Federal Reserve who were encouraging the elimination of the stock certificate. Was there any debate about that within BASIC, or was it pretty clear from the beginning that immobilization was the solution?
The debate lasted for about 15 seconds, and it was driven by strong feelings coming out of Congress that there are too many Americans who want to have their physical stock certificate. And if we try to legislate it out of business, you're going to have a lot of angry voters. So don't do it. And that went from Congress to the SEC to BASIC. Mm-hmm. And that was decided that way. And that took a very short period of time.
Was BASIC ever directly in touch with Congress, or was it usually through the SEC?
I was directly in touch with Congress. Herman met probably somewhere between 10 and 20 times with congressional leaders on both houses. John Morse of California was the sort of the point man for Congress on this, and Herman testified in front of his committee, and Herman was a cool cookie, and being a humble country boy, was able to meet them on their own turf, and he just won them over.
Mm-hmm.
But he listened very well, and the listening involved, we got to keep the stock certificate.
Okay.
Now, there was, however, a very emotional and sometimes angry group of brokers who believed in the punch card stock certificate. And there were a number of vendors who developed a certificate, engraved certificate. You know what engraving is? You crush the ink into the paper. And one was Federated Banknote Company. It was a British company, and it produced a stock certificate with an engraving of Churchill on it. Punch card, this was. And everybody saluted this thing. Everybody from the brokerage side saluted this and said, isn't this wonderful? And even some of those people on the BASIC task force, including me, said maybe we should go down this path as well in case something goes wrong and CCS gets derailed and we'll have this as backup. And wise old John Meyer from Morgan said, how do we know that this punch card certificate will really behave like a punch card? Because you're crushing it and putting ink into it and so forth. And the broker said, no, you're just an old fart. You're in the way. Well, he said, called me, he said, Bill, I want you to do a test. You're the technologist guy on the task force. And I want you to do a test of these Federated Banknote Company punch card stock certificates. So I got a bunch of certificates from Federated, and they had been stored. When I say a bunch, it was maybe 2,000 or 3,000. They were stored in an ordinary office environment. No special humidity control or anything, just the way you would store punch cards. And I got these certificates and I took them to the back office of the leading proponent of the punch card stock certificate, a fellow named Jay Peek of Shields & Company, Junius W. Peek, P-E-A-K-E, very bright guy. And I said, I've been ordered to put this through your machinery. Well, Peek had one of the most modern back offices from the standpoint of machinery the perspective of machinery. And he said, okay, I'm going to take you over here. And he's one of these hands-on guys. He says, give me some of these certificates, these punch cards. And he had a Honeywell high-speed card reader that would read 3,000 cards a minute. It's hard to believe. And it had an open belt, and the cards would come down a stack and then go on the belt and be carried across through a photocell reader. And put the cards in, and the cards would go across the belt, and they would never get to the photocell. They'd fly across the room. He said, well, what's going on here? I take the cards and stack them again and so forth. This happened repeatedly. And he happened to have the Honeywell maintenance man on site at the time. And he said, your machine is out of order. You know, it's throwing these cards out. And the Honeywell man said, no. And I've got all the equipment. It's perfectly in tune. And he said, let me see the card. The Honeywell fellow did. And he said, this card has got a bulge in it. And the bulge came from the intaglio printing press pushing the ink in. And it made it Bernoulli's principle of the airplane wing. Mm-hmm. So we had these airplane wings flying all over Jay Peake's back office. And Jay Peake said to me, this is terrible. This shouldn't have happened. He said, you're not going to tell Herman Beavis about this, are you? I said, wow. No, Jay. So, of course, when that got back, it was a big meeting of a lot of brokers at the clearinghouse, maybe 50 brokers. And I gave a report, and Jay was sitting in the front seat, and he knew what was coming. He was red as a beet. And I said what had happened and flew around the room. And I said it was an unmitigated disaster. Tried similar experiments in punch card, card punches, IBM standard, the 026 card punch machines. The cards got jammed. And so what had happened was, the crushing of the fibers in the card made it a non-punch card, made it something different. Gave it to IBM. IBM put it through their labs and concluded that it was not a punch card, and it never would be. And that was the end. And it was a famous story that not many people remember on purpose. Let it out of their heads. But it was a fun story for me, being in the middle of it.
So what other projects was BASIC working on at this time? For instance, there was the imposition of uniform forms for communication between banks and brokers.
Right.
Maybe you can tell me about that.
Yes. Each broker, each bank, had their own unique forms, different shapes, different sizes. And they thought their forms were the best ever designed, each of them. And I had to go, it's a similar story to Jay Peake, I had to go to visit one of the leading proponents of having a uniform form based on their forms. And this fellow was a head cashier for a big brokerage house, which I think it was Dean Witter. In any event, he had a handful of these forms, receive instruction forms, in his hand. And he said, see, each one is different, and I can see right away, here's one that sticks out, it's orange, and if I want to get that one, it's from Shields, I can just pull it, I can pull it out. As he pulls it out, all the forms go right all over the floor. And he said, well, that doesn't happen all the time. And that was a big boost. And the biggest brokers got behind the idea of a uniform form, and I wound up, with the help of forms design people, designing four uniform forms that were the most commonly used forms. And BASIC had no authority itself, but it could recommend to the regulators that the regulators require their member firms, in the case of the banks, the members of the clearinghouse, that they use those forms. And that's how BASIC imposed that. And In fact, I can remember it was Walter Wriston again. He said, I understand there's a lot of complaining about, you know, maybe the form is too big, it's too small. But, you know, Herman, he said, this was at a basic meeting, he said, if we can't agree on putting the date on the upper right-hand corner and the money in the lower right-hand corner, we can't make that simple thing happen. How is anybody going to take us seriously when it comes to something like a depository? And everybody saluted and said, his homespun wisdom carried the day. So that was uniform forms. And then there was the automated transfer instructions. Mm-hmm. I'll be brief on that. When a retail customer wants to take physical possession of their certificate, what happens is a broker will put an instruction into the transfer agent, usually a big bank, and that instruction has a certificate with it, the certificate typically in the name of the broker. And they want to transfer it into the name of James. And it goes to the transfer agent, and then the transfer agent takes it in, and it's been keyed by the broker on the way out, and the transfer agent takes it in and rekeys it into his computer, then issues a certificate, gives it back to the broker, and the broker mails it out to James. It was so obvious that the answer was to agree on a set of standards so that the output from the broker would be in the same standard communications discipline as the input to the transfer agent. Transfer agent take it in, read it directly into a system, save anywhere from 50 to 75, maybe 100 clerks keying all this stuff in and making mistakes when they're keying it.
Sounds simple in retrospect.
It was obvious to somebody with a systems background to say, you know, why don't we do this? And other people started to dig into it and said, you know, let's do it. But there's always the recalcitrant who says, you know, I'm not going to convert to a standard format. So leave me alone. Leave me out of it. And then DTC stepped up to the plate and said, what we will do is we will take all these instructions from the broker and we will format them for you transfer agents. And then the transfer agent said, okay, as long as you'll handle the conversion.
Because you're saving them the effort of doing
it. You're saving them the effort.
And the cost.
Programming and the cost. The operations people at the time, too many of them were not far-seeing and couldn't see, you know, down the end of the line, 5 years out, this thing is going to save us a lot of money. And they had a short-term view of what the future was. Convincing them took a lot of doing, but gradually it was such a good idea that enough people signed on and became a great success and is the way it's done today. In fact, when the broker, when the transfer agent is finished issuing the certificate, he doesn't give it back to the broker. He mails it directly to the customer and gives the broker a message saying, I mailed it on such and such a date to such and such a customer.
Which is more logical, right? So when did BASIC wrap up its job, and how did you go from there to the DTC?
BASIC wrapped up its job in 1974, and DTC had been formed. It had been incorporated as a bank, and it had its own board of directors, and had a planning department. And Herman said, from now on, the planning for things like uniform forms and so forth can be done by the depository. We should go out of business. We've done our job. And I was the recording secretary. I had gone back to the American Stock Exchange to work part-time for Herman. And I was recording secretary for the BASIC meetings. And the very last BASIC meeting, I made that little talk about Paul Colton and Herman. And I left the room, and and Bill Dentzer, who was the chairman and CEO of DTC, chairman and CEO of DTC at the time, followed me out of the room. And he said, why don't you come to work for us? He said, you can work for me 49% of the time. It's great experience for you and you'll have a lot of fun. And he said, I need an answer soon because we're looking at other people. So I thought for about 10 seconds and I'm thinking, yes, but he's off by 2%. So next day I called him. I said, remember you said 49%? Could you make that 51? Mm-hmm. And Dentzer's a sharp cookie. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, I think we can do that. So I went to work for him. He was my primary report. And was there in marketing and getting the banks to come into the system on a voluntary basis.
What was your job title there at that point?
Vice President, Participant Services. Okay. And it was basically marketing and sales. Mm-hmm. And I had a small team of maybe, at the peak of about 15 people.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to convince people to participate in the system?
Absolutely. A lot of banks, especially trust bankers, are used to dealing with little old people who come in from time to time to the bank, people who are immensely wealthy and want to feel their stock certificates. And the idea that we're not going to have them for you anymore, we're going to give them to this thing in New York, was a tough sell for the trust bankers. And so therefore it was a tough sell for us. But in the course of several years, we managed to get that to grow a little bit at a time with good examples given by some of the more progressive banks.
Now, from the beginning, was DTC actually holding the physical stock certificates themselves?
Yes.
Did they have to get an office or something like that, or a vault?
We had a huge vault. In fact, I'm a little bit ahead of the story, but later on in the 80s, when we took on custody for bearer bonds, mainly municipal bearer bonds, over a million of different issues, we built the largest vault in the world. It was out in a Grumman site at Roosevelt Field, which is now, I guess, mainly a Macy's. And it was 60,000 square feet. It's mm-hmm. a lot of space.
Yeah.
Of R10, which is the top rated from a security standpoint. And 3-foot concrete walls and all that kind of stuff, because we had hundreds of billions of dollars of bearer bonds in it.
Which could be redeemed for cash.
Which can be redeemed for cash, but there's a misunderstanding on the part of the vast majority of people, and that is that when a bond, bearer bond, is surrendered, or one of the coupons from the bond is surrendered, the bond and the coupon have a unique number. And when the paying agent takes it in and he's going to pay out on it, he checks that number against a stop file to see if somebody might have reported that having been stolen. That was not well known. And to this day, it's not well known. But now there's hardly any bearer bonds left anyway. Mm-hmm. Congress ruled those out because there was a lot of money laundering going on.
Okay.
So that was, again, I took you away from your train of thought.
Yeah, let's go back to the 1970s here. This is before you've got the big the big vault. And you're still working with a little vault. How did you convince all these banks and trusts to turn over their certificates?
There was a lot of pressure from the brokers. We want you to take book entry delivery from us brokers. And once you try it, you're going to like it. It's so efficient. And it's so safe. And then one of the big holdouts in this whole story was all banks, David Rockefeller's bank, Chase, and the there was a senior executive there at the time who was very skeptical of the safety of DTC. And he had been told by his staff, what happens if somehow or other DTC is penetrated, either from a bookkeeping system or from the physical assets? We'll be out of luck. If we have our securities in there, what happens then? The answer was, Chase could be penetrated if it were all alone and not in the system. And then it would have to face its insurance companies and its customers all alone. If it's in this massive industry cooperative, it's in there with everybody else. It's in there with Morgan and Citibank and Merrill Lynch and every big bank and broker in the country. We're all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And that carried the day from a safety standpoint. The little old people who wanted to fill their certificates was still a problem, but gradually they were worn down and they were told that this had to happen.
Now, at the beginning, when you talk about a book entry system, was that a computer data bank or was it pen and ink in books?
No, it was all computers from the start.
Did you have backup systems in place or...?
We had the most sophisticated backup systems you can imagine. We spent, as time went on and we grew and the stakes became greater and the oversight from the SEC and the Fed became greater, we introduced additional backup, hot standby. We put a backup site in Brooklyn. We went through a tremendous analysis of the best site. We wanted to make sure that if there was ever a tsunami in downtown New York, and was would it reach this Brooklyn site as well as our main site? All those kinds of things were done. And then further down, as the late 80s and into the 90s, we decided to put a backup site in a secret location in the southeast, and another one in the southwest. And the exact location, even I don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
So only a few of the tech people knew that, or?
The top executives at the time.
Right.
But once I retired, you know, I was cut off from that, as I should have been, cut off from that knowledge. It was a need to know kind of thing. If you didn't have a need to know, we're not going to tell you.
Maybe I can convince Bill Dentzer to tell me.
He was gone. Yeah, he wouldn't tell you because, number one, he wouldn't do it, and number two, he was too long gone by that time. So that was tremendous. It was also pressure from the Fed. The Fed wanted to make sure that we were bulletproof. And that was a big driving force behind mm-hmm. that dispersion of our assets.
Okay.
So each of those backup locations were a mirror image.
Mm-hmm.
And a semi-hot standby, meaning they were maybe half an hour to an hour behind the main system.
Okay. Let me ask you, did the creation of the DTC and the initiation of this book entry system, did it have any impact on trading patterns?
Yes. The trading that you see now could not possibly have been done with physical certificates. From two perspectives. Number one is the stock loan business, which has grown, you know, exponentially over the years. And the second is going from 20 million shares a day back then when CCS was new. That was a big day, mm-hmm. 20 million shares, to 2, 3, 4 billion shares a day now. And there are days when you have double settlement because you have two trading days, but there was a holiday involved, so you can have 4 or 5 billion shares traded.
I saw some articles that suggested that it also increased odd lot trading, so trading groups of smaller numbers of shares because it reduced costs.
I think that's a fair statement. It's not at the top of the menu, but it's a fair statement. Okay. Now, there's one thing, I don't know how much time you want to spend, but one of the more interesting things that happened on my watch when I was Executive Vice President of Operations is we had a strike.
Mm-hmm. What year did you become Executive Vice President of Operations?
86, 87, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And that was one of our perceived Achilles' heels.
DTC's employees were unionized from the beginning, right?
Yes. It was a carryover from the New York Stock Exchange, the Office of the Professional Employee International Union, an arm of the AFL-CIO. And they accounted for about, at one time, maybe 50 to 60% of our total employee count, head count. They were the ones who were actually physically handling the certificates. And, importantly, a few of the jobs running the computers were also unionized.
But not all of them.
Not all of them. And through some very nuanced measures and good human relations with the union, we managed to get the computer people out of the union. And that was probably mid-80s. And because we could not have the computer systems interrupted. The physical handling of the certificates could be slowed down or whatever.
But you're still somewhat vulnerable to a strike.
Somewhat vulnerable. And some of the biggest users said, we're afraid to put our securities into DTC because we might not be able to get them out because of a strike. And we didn't have an answer to that, other than we've never had a strike, and we're never going to have a strike.
But
don't
you
worry
have a
about
strike.
It.
But eventually there was a strike.
Eventually there was a strike. And it's interesting human dynamics within a union. The employees who are older and can see their retirement soon, their pension soon, are the most militant. They don't care if the company suffers a staggering blow. They're saying, I retire, they're okay. But the young people who had a long career ahead of them, they hope, well-paying jobs, wanted DTC to be strong and be around for a long time. So you had that intra-union problem, intergenerational. And this is true with all unions. GM, we saw it in a big way. And the militants were disproportionately the old people. And they had a strike vote. We said, strike vote will be that they will strike. And we got ready, though, and just in case. And we cross-trained all our employees, mm-hmm. the non-union employees. We got hundreds of volunteers from participants, all on the QT. They didn't want their names used, and we had secret lists of who these people were going to be. And so we thought we were in pretty good shape. And it was a Friday night, rainy Friday night, they had the vote. And the young people had families, they wanted to go home to their kids. So they didn't go to the union hall. And the old grumpy people went to the union hall, and it was a close vote for a strike. And the strike was to take place that Monday morning. We had 2 days to prepare for it. And all our preparation that had been done earlier, including getting the volunteers from the participants, who, incidentally, did not want the union to look good, because then their own employees would say, hey, look what they got out of DTC. Maybe we should have a union at Chase.
So what did you do over that weekend? You got on the phone and you talked to all these
Talked to all these people.
Participants.
All these participants. They had been pre-trained, pre-alerted, pre-trained, and including people from out-of-town banks and brokers, who viewed it as a lark. They're going to come in and stay in a hotel, do some microfilming certificates and bundling them up, then go home to the hotel, have a nice dinner, and go out and go to a Broadway show next morning, and DTC is going to pay for all of this. Hey, this isn't a bad deal. So we got many dozens of people who answered the call that way, and several hundred answered the call from local participants. And most importantly, about a third of our best employees, especially the younger ones, said, I'm going to cross the picket line. And there were threats and tires slashed and all this kind of stuff. And the strike lasted for 2 weeks. And every day that it went on, our quality of our product improved. And every day, more of the union members crossed the picket line. So that by the 14th day, more than 50% of the union members were now coming to work. And the union ran up the white flag. And what management does in that case is it makes it clear for appearance purposes that the union got a good deal. Don't rub their noses in it. Because you have to deal with these people in the future.
Of course.
So everybody came away happy. It's worth noting that this followed Ronald Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers. And I can tell you, as a senior executive of a union shop, that that so electrified senior executives and gave them so much spine. The President of the United States set an example. He was willing to risk the entire air traffic system, shut it down if necessary, for a principle. And it gave us tremendous courage.
Good story. So what was going on with the regional banks at this time? Just to switch gears a little bit.
Yeah. The regional banks used to clear their transactions through the New York Clearinghouse banks. Mm-hmm. So you'd have even a big regional bank like Mellon, which is the fifth largest trust bank in the country, would clear their trades through Bankers Trust. Mm-hmm. And Bankers Trust was handsomely rewarded for that work. Bankers Trust also would make Mellon pay up front in good same-day funds for a receipt. And when there was a delivery by Mellon through Bankers Trust, Bankers Trust would give Mellon next-day funds. So it was a day spread there. Mm-hmm. It used to just gnaw on the regional banks all across the country. So DTC comes along, and suddenly it makes it easy for regional banks to come into DTC. Mm-hmm. And by the way, DTC has this thing called the participant terminal system. So there's a terminal now in Mellon, and Mellon can make its own book entry deliveries. And Bankers Trust says, hey, wait a minute, this isn't such a good idea. And that led to eyeball-to-eyeball confrontations that we finally, in DTC, mm-hmm. won.
Right.
Because the top people in those banks had made a commitment to Congress that they would not pull out. So politics carried the day. But that was many, many, many months, several years, of tension mm-hmm. in a relationship between the clearinghouse banks and DTC staff, okay. including me. I was a bank's bad boy for several years in that area.
Now, was this after you became the president?
Oh, no. This was before. When I was vice president, senior vice president. By the time I became an executive vice president, the battle had been won.
Right. And that was in 1991 that you became executive vice president.
No. I became president.
President.
In 91.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay.
Replacing Conrad Ahrens.
All right.
Beginning of 91.
What was going on at DTC at this point in time when you became
DTC president? Had pretty much grown up. Mm-hmm. We had virtually all of the big banks in the country, no matter where they're located, as direct participants. Our computers had become robust and foolproof. We had constant testing. We hired consultants, some of the best hackers in the country to come in and try and penetrate it.
You would recruit hackers to come to try to break into your system?
Yes, and we would recruit them carefully because we didn't want them to learn too much about the system because they might do some bad stuff to us later on. Mm-hmm. But with the cooperation of some of our major participants, and Ed Goldberg at Merrill Lynch, who was he's now retired, but I was a tremendous fan of his, and he was a fan of mine. He was tremendously helpful in having his people do penetration kinds mm-hmm. of analyses and working with us. So we, the answer was an obvious answer. We had to be bulletproof. And if we ever wound up having somebody go in, somebody got in there and started stealing stuff, the whole thing would become suspect.
Mm-hmm. So around this time, the SEC was also pushing for a faster settlement period of trades, for a 3-day settlement period. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How did the DTC react to that?
Reacted poorly at first. Bill Dentzer was not a fan of T+3. So when he retired, his replacement was a fan. And I knew we could do it.
What was the objection early on there in the early 90s?
Bill felt that the thing was working well. There was no need for it. To shorten the settlement cycle could introduce additional risk. Errors, you didn't have extra time to resolve errors. And that some bad transactions would get into the system and not foul up the whole system, but those transactions could affect the other transactions going through the system. And
what was the argument for a faster settlement? What would that have helped?
One of the SEC commissioners, his name escapes me now, gave a speech in 1993 or 4.
Was this Bachman? No.
No, no.
Okay.
he had been with Alex Brown, and he gave a speech to some huge assemblage, and one of his catchy points was, nothing good can happen between trade date and settlement date. And the more you think about it, the more that is a profound statement about risk management in the securities business. If you have a trade and then something happens to that security, the price drops in the second or third day, the person who bought it says, I didn't buy that from you. Don't deliver that to me. So the more time between trade and settlement, the more the opportunity for that kind of thing to happen.
So it was more a concern about what could potentially happen rather than what had happened.
Right. And it was a time when there was a tremendous amount of focus on risk management. Risk and Other Four-Letter Words was a book, I think, written by Walter Wriston.
And there were some other settlement issues going on also, right? From next day final settlement to same day fund settlement?
That's correct.
And that was also an issue that you tackled during your chairmanship?
Yes. And Bill did not want to do that. He felt, we should let him speak for himself. Mm-hmm. He's already spoken, I guess.
No, I'll talk to him next week.
Oh, okay. Well, then he can speak for himself about his reasoning. But he did not believe in it, and when he retired, the pressure continued to mount, and I felt comfortable with it. It was a tremendous conversion effort.
What was involved in that? What sort of technical processes or other processes?
The settlement of the funds was purely by New York Clearinghouse check. No matter who the participant was, Mellon Bank in Pittsburgh had to have a New York Clearinghouse bank present a check for us or pick up and draft from us. That was pretty idiot-proof. And because of 5 days settlement, you had extra time to make sure you had the money all lined up and so forth. The industry, though, was moving away from checks and drafts and toward electronic fund settlement using the Federal Reserve wire. The misnomer that we went to Fed funds settlement is just that. It's a misnomer. Fed fund settlement takes place on the Fed wire. The same thing happens if you don't have the Fed actually making the debits and credits, but it's not called Fed funds settlement. It's called same day settlement. A fine point. Mm-hmm. But it was much more efficient. It reduced our headcount because we had many people taking in these checks and making sure they were endorsed right and so forth, and then getting them to the bank. And that, once we went to same-day funds, was done automatically. Okay. Untouched by human hands.
Another major issue that was going on during this period was the gradual absorption of the smaller regional depositories. Let's go back in time just a little bit, and maybe you can tell me about these regional depositories.
Right.
Did they arise about the same time as the DTC? Okay.
Soon after CCS and before DTC, there was a belief on the part of the regional exchanges, Chicago, San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, that if you're going to run with the big dogs, you have to have a full product line. So these people had all gone to Harvard and learned about vertical integration and all this stuff, and concluded that we, as a modern exchange, have to have a modern depository to settle our transactions. The only problem with that is depositories cost a lot of money to develop and operate, especially backup sites and all of this. And if you don't have a substantial number of transactions going through it to pay for all of that, you got a loser on your hands. And it took a long time for them to realize that. They thought they could fight it, and maybe DTC would have a misstep, and these regional banks in our area in California, here in Wells Fargo and B of A, will join us in the Pacific Stock Exchange depository. And we did not make any missteps. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to be very careful not to have too much of a siren song to these banks, such that the depository in San Francisco would say that we were practicing, you know, predatory, monopolistic practices. And so we had to, when we dealt with them, we dealt very gingerly. And we said, if you'd like to come with us, that's fine. If you want to stay with your local depository, that's fine. We'll help you do that. Whatever you want. And so we had the most non-marketing plan for those kinds of people, as you can imagine.
You were worried about being seen as a monopoly.
Monopoly, and then, you know, the Justice Department would come down on us.
Okay.
As I said, over time, it became self-evident that they just did not have the business to support mm-hmm. all the costs associated with the depository.
Right.
So they, in almost all cases, they came to us and said, would you like to buy us out? These are the depositories.
So they came to you all?
Yeah, they came to us. And we said, you know, how much money do you want? And, well, we want, you know, $25 million. And the board spent a lot of time on it, because this was clearly a board issue. And we wound up paying each of them a substantial amount of money, in the typically tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And we got their business, which didn't pay, didn't amortize the outlay we had. But politically, it was the right thing to do for the industry.
Okay.
And everybody came away happy.
Okay. Also during this period, the DTC began working with Thomson on some different products, like electronic trade confirmation mm-hmm. system. Why was that? And why was DTC interested in cooperating with private groups?
The system that we had developed initially went back to 1973. It was called the Institutional Delivery System, also known as ID, creatively. And you're aware of what it did. It took a confirmation from a broker and electronically, put it through DTC, and since we had this electronic network, we could get it out to the bank and the institutional mm-hmm. investor very efficiently, and they would come back and say, yes, we know that confirmation.
So each one had a terminal.
Each one had a terminal, and it was all, you know, things that used to be done by facsimile and by mail is now done by electronic communications, and took minutes instead of days. It worked very well, and it gradually grew slower than we would have liked. And then in roughly 1980, some of the big brokers said, let's make this mandatory. And they got a rule passed by the stock exchange to require their member firms to use ID to confirm all institutional trades. And if the institution didn't want to be part of this system, it would lose the COD privilege. It would have to settle the way a retail customer does. And the SEC approved that. And full page ads went out in the Wall Street Journal. And in fact, I think there's a couple of them in that book telling everybody this is going on and get ready for it. And it fell on DTC's shoulders to train the industry in the new procedures and how it would work. So we had a task force of about 40 people working for about a year and a half, going to every single institutional investor in the United States and training them in how to interface with us on this system. Now, Thomson, that's not going to be a problem for Thomson, had about that time the desire to get into that business. There was a lot of the institutional investors were their customers for other purposes, and they saw an opportunity to compete, and they said, you know, DTC is big and fat and bureaucratic and sluggish, called us every name under the sun, all untrue. But they gave it a run. Mm-hmm. And finally, after years of back and forth, the broker said, let's put these two systems together. DTC, it's not critical to your future. DTC spun off the ID system, and Thomson spun off their version of it, and it became something called OMGEO. OMGEO became
a separate for-profit company?
And it became a for-profit company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about preparation for the DTCC merger in 1999. Now, I know this didn't happen on your watch, but there was a little bit of preparation for it, wasn't there?
The preparation consisted mainly of improving the systems relationships between our two companies so that we would have efficient handoffs of broker-to-broker trades which were compared by NSEC. And then they would hand those off computer-to-computer to DTC to make the debits and credits. And we constantly refine that. And so that by the early 1999 into late 1999, it became clear that there wasn't any need for two separate companies. And Jill Considine, who I spoke to, and I said, have you contacted her? I don't think you had at that time. And she said, I've got amnesia on a lot of that stuff, but I'd be glad to talk to James. She did a masterful job of putting the two companies together in a way that NSCC, which was much smaller, tiny in size, the DTC, didn't feel like it was steamrolled. They came out reasonably happy. And she handled that very well. Mm-hmm. So that was late 1999 or early 2000.
So that was just after you left in 1998?
Yes. When I left in 1990, beginning of 1999.
You left at the beginning of the 1999. Right. That was because you reached the mandatory retirement age?
I had always felt that a 24/7 job that I had was just too much, and I wanted to spend more time with my family. So I was into my early 60s, and we did a search.
Tell me about the search.
Yeah. The first, there was some displeasure on the part of some directors asking me to stay around. And finally, they understood. Some of them were retiring early, too. So they said, okay, we'll do a search, and we're going to call it a selection committee of the board. We're going to select your replacement. And I was on the committee. And we had about 15 different industry executives who wanted to run their own system, be the CEO of an important company. It was going to be a lot of fun. And their interviews, in some cases, were good. None were outstanding. And about halfway through this process, Jill Considine, who was on the board by virtue of her ex officio capacity as president of the New York Clearing House, she said, I think I'd like to throw my hat into this ring. And Jill has a sparkling personality. She's smart as a tack and just is got such a command presence. And she's fun. And she's a woman. She has all these great things going on.
Which would have been a new thing for a chief executive of
right,
the DTC.
Right, in Wall Street, so, yeah. And Wall Street, very, very few.
At that time, yeah.
And she was just, she hit the hide off the ball in talking to the committee. And it was unanimous. And when she threw her hat, the rest of it was a no-brainer. And the thing that I remember most clearly is once it was decided, I was still the chairman, CEO. She came from the banks, the banking side of the business. And I was fearful that some of the brokers might resist her as an alien invasion. So I took her around to breakfast at any number of the big brokers. And one of them was DLJ. And we had a long and happy relationship with DLJ. Dick Pector was on our board, senior executive from them for many years. And we had this breakfast at their executive dining room, and there was maybe 10 of them and two of us, Jill and me. And it was lighthearted stuff. And toward the end, Gates Horn, who I think was the president of Pershing at the time, said, Jill, now that you're the CEO of DTC, how do you want us to refer to you? We wouldn't call you Madam CEO. Should we call you Chairman or Chair or Chairwoman or Chairperson? She said, ever since I was a little girl, I hoped that someday I would be the chairman of the board of an important company. And now that I've achieved that, you think I'm going to change the title? And it brought up, brought down the house, you know, everybody. And it was so ingratiating and so much fun that she won the hearts and the minds of the brokers that way. She's a great asset for us. Did a great job.
So, Bill, since your retirement, you've worked on a number of interesting projects. One of them was the Iraq Capital Markets Project, which you started on in 2003. Would you mind telling me about that?
Sure. This study was arranged by the Financial Services Volunteer Corps, an organization that was designed to tap the expertise of typically retirees, senior executive retirees, in doing you know, good things for developing countries. And Iraq had been pacified temporarily at that point. And L. Paul Bremer was the, my words, Lord High Commissioner for Iraq, sort of the John McCloy or Douglas MacArthur. And he wanted to have FSVC come in and design a modern capital markets system, especially a stock exchange and clearance and settlement system.
Now, did Iraq have anything like that before this?
What they had was a big blackboard, chalk. They put up quotes, and brokers would come in and say, I'm going to buy one of those Baghdad sparkling water company, a real company. In fact, maybe the biggest listed company of the, I think it was roughly 30 listed companies at the time. And then the transaction would take place, and the eraser would be used to put up a new quote. And the paperwork would be very manual and very simple. Checks would be handed back and forth, and certificates would be given out. Certificates were really not engraved certificates as we know them, but they were more like promissory notes in appearance. Worked fine. Wasn't good enough for the Americans. So I was one of a small group of four or five people, including a fellow from the SEC, whose name escapes me at the moment. He was director of foreign markets or something like that. I'm sure you can look that up. He was a good man. So we went over there to give advice. But even getting there turned into a great big struggle between state and defense. And even the idea of how we should fly from New York to Amman became an issue. I've got one gangly legs. I don't fly well in coach. And I said, I'm volunteering my time. I would get at least $500 an hour. I'm saving you tens of thousands of dollars of my time. And I want to fly business class. I was told that it went to the secretary level to make that decision. because consultants fly business class, that government reimburses them for business class, but they're getting paid $500 an hour. Mm-hmm. It was only 2 or 3 days before we were to go that was finally settled. That was I bring that up just as an example of how bureaucratic and clumsy we were.
Tell me when you got involved in this project.
This was the summer of 2003.
So the invasion had already happened.
Country had been pacified temporarily. Yes. That's choosing that word carefully. And it was before the insurrection started. And all the mistakes that were made. And L. Paul Bremer had a big hand in those mistakes. So we were flying Royal Jordanian to Amman. Wonderful service. And then we were going to take a puddle jumper from Amman to Baghdad. It was one of these things that was going to dodge the rockets, which were starting to be used. So we make steep turns and all that kind of thing and getting into Baghdad. And the day before we were to take that puddle jumper, there was a rocket attack on the Paul Wolfowitz in the Al Rashid Hotel. They missed him by one floor. They aimed at the wrong floor. And he obviously survived. Bremer panicked over the idea that we might fly into Baghdad. Here's these volunteer big shots from the United States. We all get killed. How will that look? So we stayed in Amman, and the Baghdad Stock Exchange people came to Amman and met with us for about a week. It was mortifying that they had to come and didn't have the courage to go and help them mm-hmm. in their hour of distress. Yeah. And we came up with a solution which was made for a modern system of thousands of issues with tens of thousands of trades a day, and it was ridiculous because it was overkill.
We were encouraged to come up with that system.
Yeah, and we should have been given is a blank piece of paper and say, design something, you know what's needed, interview these people and come up with a plan to meet their needs. And we were not given that opportunity. I went back to DTC using my connections. I retired now 4 years. And the DTC slapped together a system, cost about $1.5 million, so that they could run a DTC-like system for the Baghdad Stock Exchange on DTC's computers with high-speed lines back and forth to Baghdad. So the terminals in Baghdad, in the Stock Exchange, would look as though they were connected to a local computer just down the hall. About that time that was all done, big disruption, big cost for DTC. The time ran out, and the Coalition Provisional Authority, I think it was June 6th, 2004, I think that was the date, ran out, and the Iraqis took over, and Bremer and company were history. And the Iraqis said, that's a very nice plan you have, and we're going to put it on the shelf, and we're going back to our old way of doing things.
So it was never really truly implemented.
It was never implemented. In fact, the whole thing was so ineptly done, we couldn't even get space to put the terminals in. You couldn't get a decision out of the American authorities to get a hardened site protected against rockets and that kind of thing. Couldn't make a decision. And it was a great experience on how inept we had become in Iraq. And it was a harbinger of what was to come soon thereafter.
Well, Bill, do you have any final thoughts looking back over your career?
The greatest thing that ever happened to me in my career was my interview with Herman Vivas when he asked me if I had any things that might embarrass him. And I said, I didn't know a stock from a bond. And he said, you're just the man I want. And from that point on, I understudied one of the greatest men I ever met. Not one, I'll take that back. I understudied the greatest man I ever met for 2.5 years, almost one-on-one. And it was a tremendous education for me. And I think it prepared me for the good stuff that happened to me later on. And I hope that your effort with this historical SEC Historical Society is going to produce material that young people, especially young people, can learn from and help form their own lives and their own careers.
Well, Bill Jenneke, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it.